This is Vermont Edition. I'm Rick Sengary. We all like to romanticize about the past, to remember simpler times when we could walk to the local butcher shop for our meats. But the added convenience of finding everything at large supermarkets has meant we can buy everything we need in one all-encompassing place. But one thing we've lost is a shop where a butcher would give you his home phone number in case you needed advice preparing the holiday meal. A place where the butcher could suggest a good wine to go with a specific cut of meat. They were skilled artisans who could butterfly a chop, French a rack of lamb, and could cut a pocket into meat for stuffing. Well, there still are butchers who can perform these functions, and if our guest today has his way, there will be many more. And you might just be one of them. Cole Ward has been a butcher for most of his life and is the author of the new book, The Gourmet Butcher's Guide to Meat. Cole Ward, welcome to Vermont Edition.
Thank you. It's my pleasure.
So let's start out by defining a few terms describing people in this business. What's the difference between a butcher and a meat cutter?
A butcher is capable of slaughtering an animal, skinning an animal, gutting an animal, quartering the animal, breaking those quarters into primal cuts, and then processing them for retail sale or table-ready cuts. A meat cutter takes over where the butcher left off. In the early days, the butcher used to buy the animal at auction, bring it to his place of business, and slaughter it, skin it, gut it, and quarter it. And then he would process it, and he had just a few days to sell it because there was no refrigeration. And with the advent of refrigeration, two trades were born. The butcher would then go to the auction, buy the animal, bring it home, slaughter it, quarter it, and then sell it to the new trade, the butcher, the meat cutter, who would then process it for retail sale and display in a refrigerated case. So a new trade was born, and it's not to minimize the new trade because meat cutters in the early days were artisans as well. And a true butcher can do everything from the live animal to the retail case.
Now, in your book, you also use the term artisanal culinary butcher. Is that different from a butcher?
Well,
or is that a way of elevating what a butcher does?
I think it basically is a way of elevating, although over the years there have been some outstanding, really gourmet shops who catered to a particular clientele where presentation was everything, okay? Precision cutting and so on and so forth, and doing a lot of the fancier cuts of meat. And we explain a lot of that in the book.
Mm-hmm. Listeners, you can join the discussion on butchering. Do you pay attention to where your meat comes from and how it's raised? What do you want to know about choosing a butcher? Call us at 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211. You can also post your questions on the Vermont Edition Facebook page. Cole Ward, you started in the business at a really young age. Tell us briefly how you got into butchering.
Well, I come from an extremely large family. I have nine brothers and sisters. Wow. And my parents were separated when I was very young. And my mother was a working mom, and she raised all of us herself. And in 1960, she could no longer afford to keep the house, and she put the remaining five of us in an orphanage called the Warner Home. And after she had saved enough money, and she ended up working at the Warner Home, and then she ended up living at the Warner Home with us, she got an apartment over a little mom-and-pop's grocery store, and she was friends with the owners. And he and his wife became my godparents, and they gave me a job at 14 years old in the meat department, washing meat trays and stuffing sausages for 20 cents an hour. And I averaged 54 hours a week in the summertime and nights and weekends in the wintertime, and that money helped put food on the table.
Well, eventually then you moved to California, and you became kind of the butcher to the stars. How did that happen?
my kid brother and I, on a whim, decided we were going to head to California and seek our fortune. And we headed across country in 1977 in a beat-up old Oldsmobile and with a very limited budget. And I had a friend that had moved there a year earlier, and he'd asked me to come out, and he said we could stay with him. So we got there at 2 a.m. in the morning and sat around and had a few glasses of wine and a couple of beers, and I crashed on the sofa. And at 8 o'clock in the morning, the phone rang, and no one answered it, so I answered it, and a lady on the other end of the phone said, you applied for a meat cutter's job. And I'm thinking, I just got here. And so I said, yes, I did. And she said, you have an interview at 1 o'clock this afternoon. So I got a pencil and scrambled down the directions, and I got my friend up, and he helped me figure out where I was going. And it turned out that the owner of the meat market I ended up working at, his sister was one of the largest real estate, Century 21 real estate agents in California, and she was open on Sunday, so she was doing his interviews. And so I got there, and I just kind of fell into the job. I got the job. He hired me over the telephone. The guy was watching a football game, and he had money on it, and he didn't want to leave. So he asked me a bunch of questions on the phone, and when he told me the salary, I nearly jumped out of my boots, and I was there Monday morning and started work, and he catered to many of the movie stars in Los Angeles.
And it turned out it was a wrong number, right?
It was a she dialed the number wrong by one digit.
Unbelievable. So, that's kismet. Yeah. Hey, we got a great email from Hope. She's a 10-year-old from West Topsham, and she writes, I like Cole's DVD because it explains how to cut up meat very, very well. It has funny parts, and I'm pretty sure she's talking about the DVD, not the meat. I have watched it dozens of times. I'm going to be doing cutting in our own butcher shop on the practice pigs when we open. A 10-year-old who's taking up butchering, that's got to be gratifying to hear that someone is learning from you.
I know Hope. her father and mother and her older brother Will interned with me for 18 months at one of the markets I was at. They're incredible people. They raise pastured pork. And Hope is a sweetheart, and her father's told me that she has watched this DVD over and over, and she'd like to get into the trade. So when they're opening an on-farm slaughtering facility, and I have promised to go down and spend some time refreshing them when they open. And they do a wonderful job. They're incredible people.
That's fabulous. Well, you have been in the meat industry and butchering for most of your life. How has it changed over the years?
There's been many changes over the years. When I first started, it was all hanging carcasses. And you apprenticed for 2.5 to 3 years to get the basics. And much of what you learn as a retail butcher is experimentation. Okay, there are basics that you need to follow. There's certain ways, certain cuts, certain procedures that you do have to follow. Much of your display is imagination, okay? What can you sell? What would I eat? Adding value to products, learning a better, more efficient way to do things. But it becomes like doing a sculpture after a while. You want a meat case to look as pretty and as appealing as it can. So your cuts need to be uniform, and there's certain procedures to follow to make a tray of steaks, for instance, look extremely presentable, okay? And it's different today. Everything comes in boxes, okay? And your primals are all broken down. They're vacuum-packed. The boxes are labeled. You learn how to slice them, and that's pretty much it. Most everything is boneless today. In the days that I started, everything was bone-in. It was brutal work, okay? It was messy work. Someone had to break all these animals into the primals and then turn them into retail.
You keep using the word primals. You should probably explain that to listeners.
When you take a beef and you cut it in quarters, okay, mm-hmm. You have a forequarter and a hindquarter. Each one of those pieces has primal cuts that you would get certain retail cuts out of. Example, the term for sirloin, the piece that it comes from is either a bone-in top butt or a boneless top butt or a hip. That would be your primal or subprimal. You either bone that out, take the bone out of it, and slice that into retail sirloin steaks, or you might want to take it a step further and cut it into restaurant-style sirloin steaks, which is basically just the heart of the subprimal. Your short loin would be your other subprimal as one piece. The sirloin and the short loin. Or the top butt and the loin when they're connected together is called just the loin. When you separate the two, you have a top butt and then you have a short loin. So those are your primals. Your primals are where your retail cuts come from, your table-ready cuts come from.
I'm speaking with Cole Ward. He's the author of The Gourmet Butcher's Guide to Meat. Cole, have you seen a resurgence of interest in the kind of butchery that you learned that you've been doing for all these years?
In the last 10 or 12 years, there is a major interest in butchery for a variety of reasons. Some people want to learn how to butcher their own. Some people have a dream of opening a restaurant or a meat market. Some people just want to know how to shop better for cuts of meat. But most of all, people want to know where the meat comes from. Mm-hmm. Okay, the factory-farmed meat industry has preyed for many, many years on the ignorance of the consumer. And during the 70s and 80s and so on, so you're pretty much on your own in the supermarket. In the old days when you had what we called service cases, and that's a case where the butcher actually reaches in and gets the meat for you. It's unwrapped and so on and so forth.
Right.
The butcher taught you how to cook and taught you the best method to cook certain cuts of meat. The butcher also would give you recipes, and it was a total different ballgame. Your butcher was as important. And in California, when I was at the gourmet shop, your butcher was as important as your hairdresser.
And, well, for me, I think the butcher is more important. You know, you talked about knowing where your meat comes from, mm-hmm. and that brings us to hunting in Vermont. So many hunters here. When hunters shoot an animal, they then have to deal with the carcass. Would you consider the deer processors in the state, are they butchers? Is that what they would be doing? Yeah,
most of them are, and some of them are people that just know how to cut their own, and they just either do it on a sideline. There's a variety of different ways to process each animal, whether it's wild game or whether it's beef, pork, or lamb. There's a few different methods, and each butcher will approach it in a different fashion. But in some sense of the word, they are meat cutters, and many of them are experienced retail meat cutters who do it on the side.
Mm-hmm.
You know, for years and years, and many, many years ago, when people hunted, they processed their own meats.
Yeah.
And were they qualified butchers or meat cutters? Probably not, and many of them probably take a little more time. It's a little harder for them. But there are a lot of meat cutters out there that do process wild game for hunters.
Are there butchering skills that hunters should know that would be helpful when they're out in the field?
My biggest issue with hunters in the field that bring venison in, and I don't cut venison anymore, basically for that reason. I've seen too many of them come in so nasty, not cleaned. And, you know, even in your slaughterhouses, beef carcasses get washed in cold water and so on and so forth. And I don't deal with the carcasses anymore because they just come in so unsanitary to me.
Gotcha.
And there's some guys that do a great job and some guys that just don't have the skills.
Mm-hmm. Listeners, we're talking about butchering. Have you ever ordered a special cut at a butcher shop? Or do you feel confident enough to do so? Do you have a question for Cole Ward? He's been a butcher all his life. You can call and speak to him at 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211. You can also join the discussion by posting your question on the Vermont Edition page at vpr.net. Cole Ward, what are some of the things that people need to know to be a true butcher?
There's a variety of things. And first of all, you need to find a place to intern or apprentice, okay, if you want to be a true butcher. And I think you need to be a true butcher, you do need some slaughterhouse experience, okay? You need to be able to slaughter and skin and gut an animal. But there's a variety of other things. You need to we call some people in the business a natural. I've taught many people who just had a natural knack for it, and they pick up very rapidly. And then some people you really have to work hard at to teach them. So it's more than just about cutting. If you're going to run a butcher shop, you need to know about margins. You need to know how to do cutting tests to find out what your actual costs are. You need a really good personality to deal with customers, and the customers are what keep you in business and pay your wages. So it's important that the customer is always treated with respect, and they should come before anything. I believe honesty, integrity are key issues, which I think much of that's been lost in the industry over the years.
Well, let's flip that around then. And how does a consumer, what should they do to choose a butcher?
They need to ask lots of questions. in my opinion, a really good butcher shop will have an open door policy, allow you to inspect their facility, to inspect their machinery, to make sure that it's sanitary, it's clean. If you're not happy with what you see, then it's not probably the best option for you. Your butcher should be knowledgeable about the different cuts of meat, different cooking methods. He should be knowledgeable, if it's local meats, about different breeds. If he's selling or she is selling local meats, they should know as much about their supplier,
sure.
How the farmer raises the animals, whether they're administered antibiotics or growth hormones, whether they're humanely raised. Those are all important questions to ask.
Let's take a call now from Lucas. He's calling from Charlotte. Lucas, thanks so much for calling Vermont Edition. What's your question or comment?
I'm just curious what his favorite cut of meat is.
My favorite cut of meat is probably now the teres major, which is a very small muscle that lays under the shoulder blade in the forequarter, or the chuck of the animal. And I find it to be extremely flavorful. It's the second most tender piece of meat in the animal, next to the filet mignon. And it's a fabulous cut of meat. Flat iron is another cut of meat that I really like. They're overlooked cuts of meat. People tend to go for the higher-end cuts like ribeyes and New York strip steaks and filet mignon, and they overlook the fact that there's so much flavor along with the tenderness in some of these other lesser-known cuts.
Now, that first one, again, was repeated.
It's a teres major, and it's also known as petite tender.
Ah, okay. And how would you prepare it? You're a butcher. If I came in and bought it, you'd give me that advice.
Myself, I would probably just wave it over the frying pan, okay? But it's something that's great on the grill. It's something that's best if it's cooked medium rare or rare. I like grilling my steaks.
So we also had an email from Joe, and he said, I'd like to find some place besides frozen in co-ops to buy meat that was pasture-raised with no hormones or antibiotics. Is there such a butcher?
I think you're going to see such a butcher in the near future, okay? There's a young man I know who is working on opening such a facility. Again, there's different questions. Pasture-raised, is it pasture-raised and pasture-finished? Is it pasture-raised and grain-finished or corn-finished? Is it administered antibiotics or growth hormones? The most important few questions that I used to receive from customers that were concerned with their local meats is it raised locally? Mm-hmm. Is it antibiotic-free? Is it hormone-free? And is it humanely raised? Those are the most important factors concern people in their local meats. I think that you will find, and it's a lot of work, and the problem is when you're buying whole carcasses of animals to butcher and sell in a retail market, that a side of beef only has one of every cut. Okay, you have one New York strip, one tenderloin, one sirloin. So if you sell a lot of sirloin steaks, then you have to figure out how you're going to acquire more sirloin steaks, because you can't buy, if you sell six, you can't buy six sides of beef just to satisfy your sirloin customers. So that's a hard issue. You have to be able to market everything.
Okay? That's interesting. We're speaking with Cole Ward. He is the author of The Gourmet Butcher's Guide to Meat. Listeners, you can join the conversation by calling 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211. This is Vermont Edition on VPR. I'm Rick Singeri, and this is Vermont Edition. As I was growing up, around the major holidays, we'd get a call from Stuffco the Butcher. He'd check with my father to see if we needed any kielbasa, blood sausage, or slab bacon for the family gatherings. It wasn't until years later that I realized how special it was to have a butcher who provided the meats that kept the ethnic traditions alive in my town. Like Stuffco's, many of the local butcher shops were supplanted by the pre-wrapped meats that one could grab quickly at a grocery store. But our guest today is one of those butchers who has found a way to survive and even thrive as the local food movement has now taken hold. Cole Ward has been a butcher for most of his life, and is the author of the new book, The Gourmet Butcher's Guide to Meat. And listeners, you can ask Cole Ward your questions about butchering. Call 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211. You can also post your questions or comments on the Vermont Edition page at vpr.net. Let's take a call from Joe. He's calling from Hyde Park. Joe, Thanks for joining the conversation today. What's your question or comment?
Hi. I worked with Cole for over a year, and he was the person who basically taught me how to become a butcher. And I was wondering if you might be able to just talk a little bit about, you know, how young people can get into it, because it's definitely an aging industry, and it's important to get young people into it. So I wanted to have him talk a little bit about that.
Joe, how old were you when you apprenticed with Cole?
Sorry?
How old were you when you apprenticed with Cole?
Oh, I started when I was 25, and so I worked with them for over a year, and I still work with them fairly often. So.
Oh, that's great. Well, let's answer his question. How do we get young people into this?
Joe was a great apprentice, and in fact, my last two apprentices were Joe's, and it seems that they have a knack for butchering. First of all, you need to find someone who will let you work with them in both retail and on-farm. I go to a lot of farms and process, and sometimes we process for free just to have the opportunity to teach with those animals. So, and you need to spend a good year side-by-side with one butcher where you're not distracted by a ton of other things, that you're not the – even though we started out as cleanup boys, you need to learn some of those things. You need to learn sanitation issues and so on and so forth. Many people are trying to take a one-week or two-week workshop and think that it'll make them a butcher. And there's too many things to impart and to be able to do that. So you really need to find someone that you can work with for a year or two, and it's best in a retail setting, okay? But you have to find some way, and I've found it by going to the farms and processing for people who are raising animals just for themselves so we can process them without inspection and so on and so forth. So it gives us access to those animals. And you need to be able to learn the whole carcass part of it, okay? Mm-hmm. So and there's very few of the older guys yet, but there's a lot of up-and-coming young butchers who have learned the trade and worked with some old-timers, and some of them have learned many of the things on their own. And a lot of them are offering classes or internships.
Okay? Wow. A lot of hope for the future.
Yes.
Let's take another call. Liz is calling from Parrish, New York. Liz, thanks for calling Vermont Edition today. What's your question or comment?
Hi there. As a little girl, I used to cut up whole chickens. I also come from a very large family. Cole mentioned that he came from our nine. I beat him, at least close to double to that. So I would consider myself, I guess, a cutter. But I was always wondering the proper way of cutting up this chicken, because I would always start with the auxiliary, like the wings and the feet, and then I would start attacking the center part of the chicken. But, you know, I just wanted to make sure I was cutting it the right way, and then I just have two more questions. One was, are you going to hold any classes on how to cut up, like, different bulk types of meat? And how about sausages? What do you do about sausages?
All right, let's start with the chicken.
Okay,
thanks for calling. Let's start with this, a quick primer on how to handle the chicken.
Chickens, we show actually how to cut up a chicken on the CD that's included with our book, okay? And we usually clip the wings off first. We disjoint the legs and on both sides, and then we remove the backbone. And then we split the breast in half, and then we usually separate the drumstick from the thigh. It's quite a simple process, and you have a couple steps further to go when you're dealing with chickens that you're butchering yourself, okay, such as your feet. But the feet make the most incredible chicken broth that there is, okay? Some stores, and especially in ethnic communities, you can still find chicken feet. They're big in places like Massachusetts, okay?
Yeah.
We will be holding some workshops periodically. We kind of do them on the spur of the moment because it's when the animals are available for us. We're trying to work something out with a farm actually over in Sable, New York, a young lady who has a farm over there, and we'll be over there on Saturday. And oftentimes we'll take one person in for the day because we're limited for space. We are working on starting doing a sausage workshop here in the near future. I deal with fresh sausages. You do have butchers out there that specialize in other things such as charcuterie, cured meats, and Those aren't things that I get too much involved in, but fresh sausages I love, and it's imagination, and you can do wondrous things with pork and fresh sausages.
I'm pretty sure Liz is going to be the first person to sign up for the sausages workshop, and we will have a link to your website so people can find your website and know when you're going to do these classes. That's going to be at VPR/Vermont Edition. You can find that. So Liz did bring up chicken, and she's a cutter, as she said. Chicken, is it the gateway animal for home butchery? Is this kind of where most people start?
Not necessarily where they start. I usually start people out with pigs. Okay, pigs are pretty straightforward. They're relatively easy after you've done a few. It just seems to be the easiest way to start people out. Chickens are very simple. Chickens you can teach somebody in 20 minutes, okay? Pigs, it takes a few pigs. Mm-hmm. And once they have the knife skills with pork and beef and lamb and so on and so forth, chicken's a breeze, okay?
I like that. Our guest today is Cole Ward. He's the author of The Gourmet Butcher's Guide to Meat. And listeners, you can ask your question of Cole by calling 1-800-639-2211. Let's go back to the phones. Karen's calling from Dannemora, New York. Karen, thanks for calling Vermont Edition. What's your question or comment?
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I'm so curious about this whole issue of humanely slaughtered. Customers often ask for humanely raised, but the last mile of an animal's life sometimes involves very stressful transport to a USDA certified facility. What's the current status of that stress that's put on the animal, and what are some possible solutions I've read about, but I know they're not widely deployed, like mobile USDA slaughterhouses? You know, what about on-farm slaughtering, that kind of thing?
Well, I'm not sure exactly what the rules and regulations are for on-farm. I know that you can slaughter your own on-farm for your own use, mm-hmm. okay? There was a bill passed a couple of years ago, an on-farm slaughter bill, and I don't think people are able to work under that right now because the federal regulations don't allow it, okay? So I think on-farm slaughter is extremely humane, okay, and I think the animal is slaughtered in its natural surroundings. It's very comfortable. I've seen on-farm slaughter. I know several guys who do it and do an incredibly humane job. It needs to be quick. I think on the transporting the animals, I think if the animal is detained for a few days before it's slaughtered, that the stress from transportation may go away. Stress does affect the quality of the animal when it's slaughtered. Humane treatment is, in my opinion, it's an ethical issue, okay? Mm-hmm. And I'm a firm believer that the animals deserve to be treated humanely as they're alive, and they deserve to be humanely slaughtered. And there's been many studies, and I can't reference the universities that I read about these studies right now, but there were studies on different methods of slaughter, and it can be an issue that you can get really involved in. My personal opinion is that the halal method is probably the most humane, and that is based on some of the research I've done issues that were studied by a university in Germany, a university in Texas, and so on and so forth. So I think it's important that we're as diligent as possible in making sure that these humane practices are there. And again, as you said, not only the life of the animal, but the humane death of the animal as well.
We did get a message from Dana who asked, can you address federal and state inspection of meat processors? Do you know a lot about that?
Not without sitting down and reading a little bit. I mean, I know the basic rules and regulations that we need to follow in retail establishments. I'm not as up to date with slaughterhouse requirements. I know that we're very stringent here in Vermont. We have some very good enforcement. We have some great inspectors. We do have some great slaughterhouses in Vermont. Not many, not enough, but we do have people who are doing a great job and do it very humanely. You do have the other end of the spectrum where there are people who, you know, just they break the rules.
Mm-hmm.
It's unfortunate. It exists. We're pretty good at recognizing that here in the state. I think our rules are probably more stringent than the federal guidelines in Vermont, and I think we're very fortunate in a small state like this.
Now, Cole Ward, you are a guy who knows meat, so I'd be remiss if I didn't ask you to help listeners to pick out cuts of meat. What should somebody look for in a cut of beef, for instance, when they go to a butcher shop?
Again, it depends. Are you buying local or are you buying the factory-farmed commercial stuff in the supermarket? Personally, I prefer nothing less than a choice. I preference a premium choice, which is usually sold, if I'm going to buy commercial meats, it's usually sold as a branded product. And there are several companies out there that claim that they hand-select particular cuts for the marbling in the muscle meat and the exterior fat. I've found that most of those brands that are labeled premium choice are very consistent in their quality and in their yield. I look for that. I'm not a person that likes the select beef. It's too lean. It lacks flavor and it lacks tenderness, in my opinion. I like to buy local when I can buy the local that I prefer, mm-hmm. the local that I like. And I have several favorite farmers. North Hollow Farms in Rochester, I think, does a good job. A very honest farmer. Paul List, who raises a low-line Angus cattle, has an incredible beef that I like. Sugar Mountain Farm raises great pork, as does North Hollow Farms in Rochester, Vermont.
So another question then, too, is about aging. And Alexandra writes, My late mum-in-law had a butcher in Boston many years ago, and she had her red meat hung, quote, until it turned blue with mold. Best meat I ever have had. Does anybody anymore hang meat long enough? First of all, what is the right amount of aging for beef, and is anyone doing that?
That's a difficult question to answer, specifically because much of it depends on the animal. It depends much on the breed. It depends on the fat covering. The fat covering on an animal allows you to age it longer. What happens is a 7-day aging, dry aging, increases the tenderness by 25%. 14 days increases the tenderness by 45%. 21 days increases the tenderness by 65%. And then it becomes very small increments after that.
Mm-hmm.
And then certain grass-fed beef and grass-finished beefs do everything they're going to do within 2 weeks. So it doesn't change much. Aging does affect flavor as well. Okay, you can get a very nice nutty flavor out of a meat that's been aged, a nice choice meat that's been aged for long periods of time. And again, there's a lot of factors involved, so it doesn't aging times don't apply to one particular type of meat. You really need to know what you're dealing with for meat to know how long you're going to age that particular animal.
Now, I'm imagining a lot of people who are interested in butchering will pick up your book. How can someone use the book to become a home butcher?
Well, it has a lot of information in there. It will probably – there's a CD in the back of the book that has photo instructions of cutting. It's better than just trying to teach yourself, okay? It's a guide. It's a help. It's easier to work with someone, but the book does include the CD that gives you instructions, and it's one style of cutting, as the DVD was a different style of cutting, okay? And there's many different styles, and it depends what you're trying to learn for. Is it for your home use? Is it something you're going to raise to sell? Is it your business?
You still enjoy butchering all these years later?
I do. I enjoy the teaching part of it more than anything, and it's been a trade that's been very good to me, and I was so happy that I was able to stay in it as long as I have.
Cole Ward is a butcher, and he's the author of a new book, The Gourmet Butcher's Guide to Meat. Cole Ward, thanks so much for being on the program
today.
Thank
you for having me. It's been a pleasure.
And coming up, the new farm bill includes a provision that allows a few states to cultivate industrial hemp,
Vermont is one of those states. We'll learn what that might mean for the UVM extension. This is Vermont Edition on VPR. Welcome back to Vermont Edition. I'm Rick Singeri. The new farm bill, signed into law by the president earlier this month, includes a provision allowing very few states to cultivate industrial hemp. Vermont is one of those states, and Heather Darby, a UVM agronomist, is looking into planting hemp perhaps as early as this spring. Heather Darby, welcome back to Vermont Edition.
Hi, how are you?
Fabulous. Nice to have you back. Now, this new farm bill allows pilot hemp programs at colleges, universities, or departments of agriculture in states that already permit the cultivation of hemp. Vermont passed a law permitting the cultivation of industrial hemp last year, so we're one of those states. How does the language in the new farm bill change what was possible here in Vermont?
Yeah, last year when that bill was passed, it allowed really farmers or anyone to plant industrial hemp. But because the federal government had not given the okay, then obviously if someone were to go ahead and plant industrial hemp and the federal government didn't like it, then they still, may be prosecuted through the Fed. So I would say it wasn't overly welcoming for anybody to try to do that. But now with the new farm bill, the language in the farm bill actually allows a little bit further progress, which essentially is allowing, universities, and as you mentioned, agencies of agriculture, et cetera, to actually start testing, experimenting, and putting out pilot agricultural projects in industrial hemp. So now we have the backing from the farm bill and one part of the federal government and also the state. So the doors are opening up. There obviously are still some barriers and challenges, though, to making all this happen.
Well, what are those? What needs to happen next to allow you to actually plant seeds?
Yeah, well, I think from, of course, from a university perspective, we have to make sure that not just the farm bill says it's okay, but really all aspects of the federal government. And this would include folks that are with the DEA that really watch sort of, drug production, I guess, or hemp production or marijuana production, let's say that.
Sure.
And so making sure that the blessings are from all aspects of the federal government, not just something that's written in the farm bill. So you would think that all aspects would be all parties would be a go, but really the sort of fact of the matter is it's not. So we're sort of working through that to make sure that we have a strong go ahead from the federal government, not just sort of a soft one, I guess, because we don't want to be caught with some significant liabilities and sort of issues as well. If not everyone supports this.
Will it be difficult to actually get the seeds to launch this pilot program?
Yeah, that's another major barrier. Now, of course, being a university or a Department of Agriculture, we usually can have material transfer agreements and seed transfer agreements, between countries, between universities, et cetera. So, I feel like a university has a better chance to be able to secure some seed for testing versus a farm being able to secure seed right now for commercial planting. So it certainly is a barrier trying to make sure, again, we're able to legally import seed for experimentation. So, we're working on that right now, trying to overcome some of those hurdles too.
Where might you get the seeds from?
Well, of course, industrial hemp production is allowable in Canada, so that's one place. Other parts of Europe, and then also there have been other universities in the United States that have also worked on industrial hemp in the past. So there are places to go and to look. So, those are just a few of the options that we have. We certainly want varieties and selections that would do well here in a temperate climate. So, trying to look at similar environments.
Now, I know this is a question that a lot of people wonder about. What is the difference between hemp plants and marijuana plants?
Yeah, there's, they look the same, there's no doubt, but industrial hemp, of course, does not have the THC. So, the part of the seed that causes the high, yep, in marijuana. So industrial hemp does not have THC or very, 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 very low levels. And, you know, this is really common in most every kind of crop, actually. You know, industrial hemp has been bred for high fiber production, not for THC in a seed. So, you know, breeding for high fiber production and some of the other aspects we're looking for in actual fiber leads to a natural reduction in THC in the plant. And this happens a lot in breeding. You know, you breed for one aspect of the plant and you lose other aspects of it. And that's something that's happened when breeding for industrial hemp. So if you're growing an industrial hemp variety, then you have very, very low levels of THC in the crop. And that's the major difference. And of course, you know, you have higher fiber and things like that as well. But it's the THC that's really the major, major difference.
And what are the potential benefits of growing industrial hemp here in Vermont?
Yeah, well, from the way I'm looking at it is it's obviously potential to have a specialty product coming off of our farms in Vermont. Most of our farms are diversified and looking further for ways to diversify and be unique. And growing industrial hemp for primarily, I think, in the short term for oil and for meal and seed is an easy access, I guess, market for our farmers. Growing industrial hemp for fiber requires special processing. And so growing industrial hemp for that specific byproduct, I think, is a little further out. So in the short term, we're really looking at the oil that's used in cosmetics and all kinds of products, and also for biofuels, and the meal itself that, again, is used in different products, and the seeds, too, health food products, et cetera, as a specialty niche product for our farm.
Heather Darby is an agronomist at UVM and is looking into planting hemp, perhaps as early as this spring. Heather, thanks again for joining us today.
Thanks. Have a great day.
You too. And now we turn to your messages to the show. Vermont Edition Managing Producer Patty Daniels joins me in the studio to read a few of your notes to us about recent programs. Hello, Patty.
Hi, Rick. Great to be here. Last week, we had a discussion about the new shoreline protection bill that's cleared both the House and the Senate. It's currently in conference committee. And that bill requires permits for most construction within 250 feet of a lakeshore.
Steve was worried that might not be enough to address pollution issues in our lakes. He wrote, "The vast majority of the issues with Lake Champlain in particular are the result of agricultural runoff, our sewer plants, and impervious surfaces in cities and towns. This shoreland bill may be well-intentioned, but doesn't address the most serious issues that everyone involved knows about. We need action on the big issues."
Rick, last week we spoke with Senator Patrick Leahy, and during that discussion, we talked about Senator Bernie Sanders and his trip to Cuba, and also the possibility of normalizing relationships with Cuba. And a listener named BHA wrote, "It's well past time to recognize that the Cuban government is not a threat to us or anyone else. That ended almost half my lifetime ago when the Soviet bloc collapsed. It's hard to find another country that hasn't normalized relations with Cuba."
And earlier this week, we had a lively discussion about a bill that is currently before the Senate Judiciary Committee. The bill would require all food containing genetically modified organisms to be labeled. Tom from Hanover, New Hampshire wrote, "As a plant scientist with absolutely no ties to Monsanto, I am opposed to mandatory labeling. The scientific consensus is that the products on the market now are safe for human consumption. The proposal to put a conspicuous label on GMO foods will only serve to send the message to consumers that GMO products like BT corn are dangerous and there is no solid and respected scientific evidence that they are."
Well, one of the issues with the GMO labeling bill that the senators are considering right now is whether to include a trigger. And that's a cause that would delay implementation of the law until other nearby states, like New Hampshire, would have also passed a similar law. And Stewart in Thetford Center says that he does not like the idea of such a trigger. He writes, "I asked the members of the committees to vote in favor of a bill that is not contingent on laws passed by other states. Giving New Hampshire the power to determine whether Vermont has a law that goes into effect is unacceptable. I don't have a representative in New Hampshire, he writes, and I don't have a representative in their House or Senate.
And finally, Walter is concerned about the possible economic effect of this bill. He wrote, has the legislature thought about what effect this labeling mandate will have on the thousands of small local Vermont craft food makers who either don't know whether their ingredients contain GMOs or might not be able to source non-GMO ingredients? Many of them will have to add a GMO label to their products. This could kill many of these good Vermont companies.
Well, we welcome your questions and comments and concerns about anything you hear on the show. Email us, vermontedition@vpr.net, or follow us on Facebook and Twitter.
Patty, thanks for joining me.
You're welcome.
That's it for today. Tomorrow, what makes a community sustainable? And how is that word even defined? Those questions are explored in the new book, Sustainable Communities, Creating a Durable Local Economy. And it's based largely on the experience of Burlington. We'll talk with one of the authors. Vermont Edition is produced by Patty Daniels and Sage Van Wing. Peter Biello directed the show, and our executive producer is John Van Hoosen. I'm Rick Singeri. Thanks for listening.